Welcome to episode number 23 of Indotechno. Thank you for joining us once again. Selamat datang kembali semuanya. My name is Alan Helliwell. I'm founder of startup consulting firm Gizmo Advisors and venture partner at Alpha JWC Ventures. Now, if we put juggernauts such as Grab and Gojek aside as what you might call the multi-vertical or super app plays, the largest areas of VC investment in Southeast Asia for the past 2 years have been fintech and e-commerce, according to Cento Ventures. Some of the largest business combinations in the tech world indeed reside between fintech and e-commerce, Ant Financial and Alibaba, and PayPal and eBay as two such examples. Our guest today, Akshay Garg, more than 5 years ago founded FinExcel, which operates at this intersection of e-commerce and financial services. At FinExcel's nucleus lies an e-commerce financing product, Credivo, a buy now, pay later platform to provide credit for purchases. Very excited to have you join us today, Akshay.
Thank you for having me here, Alan.
Great. So, Akshay, in preparing for today's podcast, the team discovered that much of your past routed through China. Can you share with us what led you to take an interest in Chinese and Chinese studies?
Yeah, sure. Your team's definitely done their research. I really started with taking a class in Mandarin during college, and I just fell in love with the language. I've always had an interest in languages. I don't think I'm particularly talented at them since I have to work a lot at getting them right. But I think studying Mandarin outside of the traditional world of Latin / Greco-Roman languages was a new world into itself. And that led me into taking a year off after college, spending a year in China, in Yunnan, in the Southwest, working as a research assistant to a professor with what I thought at that point in time was the sweetest gig in the world. My job description required me to assist him for 2 hours a day on economic research and essentially be a teaching assistant to him. And I could do whatever else I wanted outside of those 2 hours a day. I really fell in love with the language, ended up spending quite a few hours per day in Mandarin Chinese classes, and then any time that I got traveling around the country. So that's the start of it. And that was 2000-2001, the start of a very long fascination and love affair with the country.
We could probably devote the rest of our podcast to some of your impressions of particularly that part of China. So Akshay, you were nearly 8 years at Comly Media. Tell us about that.
Comly was founded in early 2007. I co-founded that company along with Mark Goyal and a couple of other individuals who then broke off into building out another firm called PubMatic. Comly was founded with the premise of adding a lot more intelligence to the world of marketing and advertising. Traditionally, advertising has been run in the way depicted by the Mad Men series, with lots of relationship-driven budgeting and boozy lunches and so on. But in the early part of last decade, the world of marketing and advertising was also starting to be a lot more quantified. And one of the things that was starting to come up was this innovation called RTB, real-time bidding, which was essentially bringing the same frameworks or structures of automation and real-time pricing as exists in, let's say, stock markets to the world of advertising. We had raised about $80 million of venture capital funding from some top-tier investors, both global and out of India. And eventually, the company exited to Axiata, the Malaysian telco. So what is called AdKnowledge, which is Axiata's digital arm, is really a rebranding of Comly Media. They acquired the assets of that business in the year 2014. It was a very exciting play. I learned a lot about the world of data, and that's frankly what brought me here to FinExcel.
So Akshay, under what circumstances was the idea for FinExcel and Credivo born?
Credivo won't be here if it weren't for my days at Comly. Part of what I did at Comly was a lot of work on the data side of things. By my background, immediately prior to joining the working world, I was enrolled in an integrated doctoral program in economics out in Western Europe. And it was a very quantitative program. And generally, I enjoy the world of data a lot. I always enjoyed playing with numbers and finding patterns in them. And that's frankly the side that I started out at Comly. But what really led to the germination of this idea around what FinExcel would do was really a confluence of a few mega waves, right? One was obviously that emerging markets such as Indonesia are no longer, from a macroeconomic perspective, poor countries. These are middle-income countries. They've touched a $3,000 per capita GDP threshold. Secondly, there's a huge amount of audience data out there through the world of Android adoption. 10 years ago, this just didn't exist. But today, pretty much anyone and everyone has an Android smartphone. Thirdly, there was this market opportunity around being able to provide credit to individuals who have historically just not been approved by banks because of the lack of credit bureau data. So it was really these three things that came together. But truth be told, the driving force around deciding to go after this opportunity was really about making a difference. It was very important to me at this point in time that I devote a really good chunk of my working life to something that really makes a difference to the lives of millions of individuals. And I was part of a pretty foundational study that was done between the International Labor Organization and the World Bank in the year 2004. This is back in the days when I was actually working at the UN as a very young junior statistical analyst, where we were looking at the role of remittances in certain markets like Senegal and West Africa, Philippines and Asia, Mexico and North America. And as we know, there's a lot of labor from these countries that works in other countries and remits money back home. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of these remittances play the role of informal credit, simply because the families of these individuals are not able to access the formal banking network back in their home countries. So there is a lot of data out there, and I was a part of a very, very important study that validated how important remittances are to the productive poor, to helping them build valuable businesses and improve their lifestyles over a period of time. And the idea here was that there is a gap in the market. There is an opportunity to make a difference to the lives of tens of millions of people in the long run. And the opportunity is very much present at this point in time. So why not? And that's what really got things started.
Very helpful background. Akshay, can you describe for us the actual Credivo product and maybe give us a sense of its popularity?
Credivo exists at the intersection of e-commerce and credit. Credivo was born at the intersection of, I would say, two really big problem areas. One was the lack of access to credit, and I just spoke about that in response to your prior question. But just to put this in perspective, right, I mean, Indonesia, which is actually the only market that we operate in today, largest economy in Southeast Asia, $1 trillion economy, 70 to 80 million people in the middle class, consumptive middle class. But a little known fact, Alan, the total number of credit card holders has not budged in nearly 10 years. It was 7 to 8 million credit card holders in the year 2008, and it's still that same number today. I know it shocks people, but it's really true. And in that same period, the middle class has more than doubled. Clearly, something's wrong. And what's wrong is that banks in general don't do unsecured lending in this market and several others in the region as well. But Credivo was not just attacking this problem. Credivo was also attacking the problem of a lot of friction when it comes to e-commerce payments. With Calmly, my last startup, our largest clients were the largest e-commerce players in the region across Australia, Southeast Asia, and India. And one of the challenges that I discovered working very closely alongside these e-commerce players was just that payment friction was just out of control. They were spending a lot of money getting customers to their websites to come and transact. But simply because of the friction involved in actually closing a transaction at the checkout, a lot of customers would drop away. So Calmly's idea really germinated from solving two problems: building out a really quick and simple e-commerce checkout, building an experience that would, frankly, from our perspective, be really addictive for a customer. And secondly, giving them something that they couldn't access in the past, which is real-time credit. So that's what really got it started. And so we created this product that was really built around pillars of really fast application, really fast approval, and instant checkout. Take the three core problem areas around application, approval time, and then transaction checkout, and basically just get these down as close to zero as possible in terms of the number of seconds or minutes it took. And that's what's basically gotten it started, and that's what's brought it here.
Akshay, what other ancillary services or entirely new products are on the roadmap at FinXL?
We're definitely thinking about a few. We have been very focused on just building out Credivo over the last four and a half years. It's now nearly 5 years in the journey. In fact, we're going to complete 5 years with Credivo in April next year. We're very actively incubating and building out a few other services. Some of them are actually inside of Credivo. So for example, instead of just e-commerce credit, we're looking pretty closely to launch products around educational healthcare loans, where customers can use the same credit limit to also, for example, take lower interest education loans. And some are outside of the entire Credivo brand, but we're thinking about incubating a few other services in other spaces of the credit spectrum.
Fascinating. Sounds like it's very fertile grounds. You mentioned, Akshay, that FinXL's current focus is Indonesia. Do we have any expansion plans in the cards?
Yes, sir, we do. And by now, we should have been present in at least one other country in the region. But because of this little thing called COVID-19, some of those plans have been put to rest for the time being. The fact of the matter is that some countries are still under lockdown. There's no travel at this point in time, obviously. For this year, we're really pulling back from international plans, but assuming that the situation starts normalizing over the next quarter or two, we hope to make an entry into at least one other market. And aspirationally, we'd like to be present in at least two markets outside of Indonesia by the end of next year. The markets that we're looking at are essentially other, I would say, markets with very low access to credit. It will be countries like Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand to some extent, even though Thailand is actually in a far better situation with access to credit than many other markets in this part of the world.
Now, if we take the time around FinXL's founding around 5 years ago as the starting point of today's fintech scene, what would you say have been the highlights and the lowlights of the overall industry throughout those intervening 5 years?
Before I get into the highlights, it's probably important that I give some background around why some of these things are the highlights. Southeast Asia is still a very young tech ecosystem. There's been several other companies. Tokopedia, Bukalapak started even before us. These are just a couple that I called out amongst a few other companies that have been around for nearly 10 years. We're just 5 years old. It's not the US, it's not China, or even India in terms of the amount of capital available or the amount of talent available. And these two things, talent and capital, are in general the two pillars that really drive the tech industry in any part of the world. Lack of access to capital when we started out is the problem that's definitely gotten better. Lack of access to talent is also getting better. But we're still at a point where in general, the best and brightest still think about joining a more stable career than a startup. So bring this all together to what are some of the highlights. Access to capital has definitely improved. When we started out, there were a few early stage funds that were trying to solve the seed to Series A problem. A couple of years out, there are a few funds that were trying to solve the Series B problem. And now, if you look around the market, as far as capital availability, there's plenty of capital available around seed, Series A and B. The big problem is, what do you do post-B? You still find a lack of very large capital pools that sit between that category and the private equity guys. That will improve, but one highlight is the lack of access to capital has definitely gotten better. The second highlight I would say is that there's definitely more high-quality talent available in a market like Singapore, less so in some of the other markets in Southeast Asia, where in general, people tend to be still more risk-averse. The best and brightest are still thinking about banking, consulting, law as traditional career choices. We just have to work that much harder to attract great talent, but the situation is improving. In terms of lowlights of the industry, building companies, whether it's in fintech or anything else, is never easy. We eat challenges and problems for lunch and breakfast every single day. But I would say one of the lowlights is probably coming from the fact that this is still a really early stage ecosystem. I feel like a bunch of times, whether it's investors or employees, people think that they can get away with anything. Some of the things that I've seen, and if you talk to any other founder that has built a significant business in this part of the world, people will tell you that you see certain behaviors that you don't have in a more evolved market simply because reputation is a very important currency. But you see all kinds of things here. People deciding not to join after they've signed an offer letter from an employee perspective. Investors pulling back after deals have closed or just walking away. There's all kinds of early stage jazz, but it happens in most early stage markets. And hopefully things will get better over time.
Just as a follow-up to that, Akshay, I'm also keen to understand what challenges there have been more intrinsic to fintech. Were there any decisions that were made that have prevented fintech from becoming the colossus that everyone had hoped?
That's a great question. There's definitely challenges with the P2P regime. But let's not take away the fact that certain markets like Indonesia have been very forward-thinking and proactive in creating a P2P regime. Unlike markets like Vietnam or Thailand, where nothing like that actually exists, this has also led to the creation of certain credit plays, including us. I mean, that's how we started out, Alan. We're now no longer a peer-to-peer company. We operate under a multi-finance license. But starting out, that was the best access point for us and many other companies. Back to your point, the core point there is that whether it's peer-to-peer or multi-finance or payments, starting out, one of the areas that I might have underestimated is the sheer complexity around regulations when it comes to financial services. Simply because it is financial services, by definition, you expect it to be regulated. But regulations are complex, deep. Very often, if the regulations say that you need to have X amount of capital before you can enter a particular space, there's only so much you can do. And all of these regulations were designed with the right intentions. But one consequence of that is probably a slightly negative impact on the sheer amount of innovation that could happen simply because a lot of startups are not able to scale because of the weight of regulations in certain areas. The reality is that it's a very complex space. And back on that point, I would say one highlight is that regulators in quite a few countries, most notably Indonesia, have been very proactive in creating the right set of regulations to encourage innovation.
Now, Akshay, what crucial decisions, whether it was the product of a studied calculus or simply dumb luck, did FinXL make to get to its current position?
I would probably highlight two really core decisions that have been crucial to our success to date. And success is a relative term. We can still do a lot of things a lot better, Alan. If I were to be forced to highlight one or two things, the first would be building our own tech capabilities. There's a lot of companies in the region and also out of the region, notably from China, that are peddling credit scoring and automated collection software. And some of these are amazing solutions. But if you really have to aspire to greatness, you need to really understand what's going on end to end and control every aspect of your stack. So we've taken a proprietary credit scoring and collections approach. Pretty much anything that we do in terms of application approval or the collections engine that we run is designed entirely internally. We don't really use any external third-party software or licensing from anyone else. It seems obvious now, but a little bit of a head-scratching move in the early days, whether it was certain members of the management team or some investors, but it's paid off because when we see the kind of results that we're actually driving, even in the midst of what is a very deep economic slowdown, which typically ends up impacting credit metrics very negatively, we can see the proof in the pudding. The fact that we know our customers and the data inside out, we know what we're doing with the algorithms really helps us control the situation and navigate the situation in a much better way than some others who might be relying on outsourced parties. That's number one. Number two was really thinking about this not just as a lending play, but as a payments and lending play. Most lending companies tend to really operate as personal loan providers or installment loan providers, helping users get access to capital when they have a large purchase coming up. But the fact of the matter is that users don't have large purchases every single day. They'll typically have one every 3 to 6 months, if not even less often. When you have such a small frequency of large purchases or large needs, you're not creating any loyalty in your customer base. The customer can easily shop around 6 months later for a different product. So it leads to, generally speaking, unit economics that are perhaps not as strong. In our case, a very important call that we took in the early days was that we have to think about retention very deeply, and that led to a product which is not just about accessing installment loans or high-ticket personal loans, but one that also simplifies payments. And that's our core Pay Later product, where you can make transactions of as low as 5,000 rupiah or as much as 1 million rupiah and pay back over 30 days at no interest at all. So the fact that we were actually not just solving for credit access, but for payments friction, ended up creating one of the stickiest payment methods for e-commerce in the country. And that's led to some very positive network effects for our installment business.
That makes eminent sense. Akshay, you've mentioned that the e-commerce platforms have clearly played a role in FinXL's success. How does that relationship evolve going forward?
We view this as a really symbiotic sort of relationship. Both parties are benefiting. We are an e-commerce enabler. It's as simple as that. It's what PayPal is to e-commerce folks in the US or what Klarna is to e-commerce players in Europe, essentially simplifying payments and access to credit. And that's exactly what we do. Our view is that we are here to essentially help you as an e-commerce player increase your sales. And that's what we do. We don't operate an e-commerce play on our own. It's a completely horizontal payments platform or credit platform that is now adopted by more than 300 merchants. 8 or 9 out of the top 10 e-commerce merchants in Indonesia are already working with us. So the fact that we don't have any interest other than helping you as an e-commerce merchant increase your sales leads to a pretty strong alignment of interests. Less than 3% of the population have access to a formal credit product. So the fact that we're really filling a core need. Secondly, our interests are aligned that we do better if we help you do better, which is to say increase your sales, really makes it a very strong and symbiotic relationship. Pretty much all of our merchants think about it the same way. We're not doing something particularly unique here. Like I said, it's no different from how PayPal is enabling sales in the US or Klarna is doing the same in Europe or others are doing in other parts of the world.
Now, Akshay, you made reference to the regulator earlier. What would you describe as the role of the regulator these days as it relates to Credivo?
Credivo in Indonesia is regulated under the multi-finance regulations. The primary role of the regulator is to make sure that we're not doing anything that harms the consumer's interests. Our lending practices, collections practices are in line with the regulations. And frankly, that we continue as a going concern. So there's several financial metrics that we need to report to regulators around the capital adequacy ratio, leverage, et cetera. And all of these are essentially meant to ensure that we will not end up doing things that are too risky for our survival long term. So the role of the regulator is to essentially make sure that they lay out the playing field and that the companies stay inside that. The regulators are doing, from our perspective, a phenomenal job with that. We're frankly very grateful to be a regulated company simply because it helps us increase the amount of trust as well in our customers' eyes.
Now, as I alluded to earlier, China has had quite an interesting roller coaster ride throughout the cultivation of the fintech industry. What are the most important takeaways you would cite from the China precedent?
I should probably study China a little bit more than I do. The one that really stands out is how the peer-to-peer industry in China has really blown up. One really important takeaway from that is that whether it's from a regulation angle or it's from a company building angle, you've just got to be a little bit more thoughtful about other ways of building a successful credit business than a peer-to-peer model, because that model definitely has some challenges. I would say that that's one important takeaway. In some ways, it's been a little bit of a warning shot or a wake-up call to everyone that that might not be the best or biggest license for people to build credit businesses. The other really interesting takeaway is that you need to respect the laws of the land and the reality of each land. In light of what's just happened with Ant's IPO, everyone's been shocked by the fact that what was the largest IPO offering in the history of public markets just got pulled 24 hours before it was supposed to go out. It demonstrates that while we're living in a very globalized world and we're building businesses, it's really important to know the territory that you're actually in and stay within those bounds as set by the regulators. It's not a space where people can just do whatever they want. It's as simple as that, and that's for a good reason.
Just continuing this line of questioning, are there any qualitative comparisons you can share with us regarding penetration or adoption of online financial products between China and Indonesia?
Qualitatively, the two things I will point out are speed and quality of execution. China blows our minds. As a founder, as an entrepreneur, I really look at what's happening in China simply from the perspective of how fast they move and how well they move, despite how fast they have moved. It's a country where time is measured, I honestly feel, not in terms of years, but hours and minutes. I still remember how much my mind was blown. Buildings were going up in a matter of months, not years. 24-hour shifts, 7 days a week. And Chinese companies take that same approach to building products and launching them. Really fast adoption, fast execution. And then the second thing I would say is that they're just building incredible products. I don't think there is any other ecosystem in the world where there is such a diversity of financial services and products available across the entire spectrum. And that gives you reason for pause, because they're creating the future in a way that no one else is. China's a great place to look up to for examples of what the future might look like in terms of financial products and services adoption, as well as speed of penetration.
You've mentioned earlier in the conversation that credit scoring is mission critical to the success of any lending initiative. What important ingredients or data does successful credit scoring require these days in your mind?
The quality of your credit scores is directly correlated with the breadth and depth of the data that you actually have. And what does that really mean? It definitely helps to have more and more data sources, and it's also very important to have high quality data sources. Just one of the two alone is not going to do the job. We wouldn't be where we were if we were not consuming massive amounts of data across a very wide diversity of sources, and not just diversity, but ensuring that all of this data was really high quality. The kind of data that's going to credit scoring today is a combination of traditional KYC data that comes out of your identity cards and which is validated with the national authorities, e-commerce data, telco data, location data to some extent. I would say those are probably the four really big buckets going into alternate database credit scoring today. It is super critical for anyone that wants to build a lending business in an emerging market to be across as many of these sources as possible, but then also have a lot of depth. Getting telco data as an example sounds easy, but it's not, because you need to tie up with each telco, negotiate with them for various cuts of data that you can actually get, and make sure that all of this is actually fully compliant with the laws of the land, because you can't obviously just go do whatever you want without customer consent. All of these problems are fairly complex. It's taken us nearly 5 years to get to a point where we actually believe that our data stack is more comprehensive than anyone else's in the market. Broadly speaking, I can't understate the importance of having a very high quality data stack. It's something that we invest a lot in.
Akshay, can you walk us through the various stages of how COVID-19 has impacted our business since the beginning of the year?
COVID-19 was a fast and furious tsunami, if you will. As far as Indonesia is concerned, we saw it coming. COVID-19 had touched the shores of the West a little bit earlier than it did Indonesia. And we saw the full brunt of that in April in the country. So starting April, we slowed down dispersals quite significantly. Peak to trough, we slowed down about 50%, slightly less than that in terms of dispersals. And the only reason for doing that is that when the risk metrics will actually deteriorate, you want to reduce your exposure, as any prudent lender would do. So you're still lending to high quality borrowers, but in general, you're just taking a more conservative approach when it comes to others. We slowed down dispersals. We saw some stress in our portfolio in Q2, which we then worked very hard to manage by doubling down on collections, tightening underwriting rules, etc. Starting Q3, we've been back essentially to a fully normal mode. Since September, end of Q3, we're already ahead of where we were pre-COVID. So long and short, we went through a stage of slowing down and essentially just reducing exposure to higher risk customers, adjusting our risk thresholds as a second stage to only onboard customers who we thought were an acceptable risk. And then to a third stage, which really started in the back half of last quarter, return to full normalcy. So from our perspective right now, the business is actually bigger than where we were pre-COVID, and we are operating totally back to normal.
That's great to hear. Akshay, what inspires you most about the Indonesian consumer? Is it a certain demographic or socioeconomic segment that you're particularly optimistic about?
As far as the Indonesian consumer is concerned, what really motivates me and inspires me about Indonesia and the Indonesian consumer is the fact that they're so experimental. They want to adopt new products and services, and they express a need for a lot more. So if you create a great product or service, you stand an amazing chance of being successful simply because customers are willing to adopt new products and services. There's a very large number of customers who are underserved by a very wide variety of financial services. We are here to try and do our best to serve as many as we can, hopefully tens of millions of customers with a variety of financial services that make their lives a lot better. That's what makes me and that's what makes my company tick.
I've always enjoyed our conversations over the years, Akshay, and I once again come away having learned a lot from you through our chat today. Thanks a lot for joining.
Well, thank you for inviting me here. This was really fun. Thanks for having me out.
You're very welcome. Today's podcast was translated from English to Bahasa Indonesia by Alpha JWC Ventures. Terima kasih telah mendengarkan. Sampai jumpa lagi. Thank you.